This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last year during hunting season, VPR commentator Willem Lang painted this picture of life at hunting camp with old friends.
There are seven of us here in camp, three young guys and four old, thus three hunters, two former hunters, and two more who haven't quite put their rifles away for good. Eric and I still wander out on short hunts during the afternoon and return in time for hors d'oeuvres before supper. Putt, the chef, gets supper ready for whenever the boys come stomping through the door with a blast of cold air and animal energy. They're off to bed in the bunkhouse around 8, get up again at 4, eat breakfast, and are in the woods by dawn.
But as Willem Lang and his buddies age, who's replacing them at hunting camp? Is hunting still an integral part of Vermont's culture, or is it fading as the number of people buying hunting licenses slowly declines? We're going to take a look at that today. We're joined now by Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Patrick Barry and by Matt Crawford, a former outdoors editor for the Burlington Free Press. Crawford now works with the public relations firm Pale Morning Media, which specializes in the outdoor world. Nice to have both of you back on the program with us.
It's good to be here.
Thank you so much for covering this issue.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about that issue of hunting licenses. Really, since 1974, hunting licenses have been going down. There have been some years that there's been a little bit of an uptick, but since 74, we can say the number has been declining. And if there are fewer and fewer people buying hunting licenses, Pat Barry, do you think that means that it's less and less a part of Vermont culture?
I think it's a combination of factors, and it depends on how you look at it. I mean, there are some bright spots. Nationally, hunting is actually on the rise, and it's up by about 9%. But there are certainly some cultural and some demographic changes in Vermont that we've seen. Again, on the bright side, Vermont also boasts the highest participation rate in outdoor-based recreation in the lower 48 states, second only to Alaska, and that includes hunting, fishing, trapping, and wildlife viewing. So we are still a state that very much identifies itself with this really important hunting culture. And there are really important reasons for maintaining that. It's not just this cultural element that we've talked about and this quintessential part of our heritage, but it's also economically very important, and it's ecologically very important. And hopefully we'll have time to get to those three. But I think that demographic shift with a change in what a lot of youngsters get into has helped precipitate that. Statistically, we do know that the number one reason that folks get out of hunting and case their Remingtons and hang up the woolies for good is because they feel like they're too old for the chase. The second most important reason, and one that the department is really trying to address head on, is loss of access. People just don't have a place to go. With that said, you know, we are actually certifying more youth hunters than ever before. We have over 300 volunteer instructors. The number of people that are coming through our programs for Hunter Ed are off the charts. The problem is that we don't see them when they necessarily get to the time of buying a license. And maybe they're heading off to college, and maybe they're starting families, and maybe they're not circling back until a little bit later. But there is this rabbit hole where we don't know how we don't necessarily keep those folks involved, especially considering that we have some of the best youth hunting opportunities in the country for youth waterfowl, youth deer, and youth turkey. So that's something we need to look at.
So we are going to talk a little bit about the economic value and why Fish and Wildlife thinks hunting is so important in terms of keeping an ecological balance and a human balance, what we humans have decided is carrying capacity for some of these species. But Matt Crawford, what do you think? I mean, if we're looking at fewer people buying licenses, and yet, you know, Pat Barry is saying this is still an important part of our culture, is it that we're holding on to a sort of a culture of the past that's not really quite as relevant anymore?
I don't think so. I think it's still very relevant. And I think one of the things I should interject here that Pat didn't quite say, really important, hunting really is one of the key funding mechanisms for his department. So if we're going to look at – we're going to charge the Fish and Wildlife Department with protecting all kinds of species of fish and fowl and wildlife for Vermonters, hunting licenses need to sort of be – a steady source of income. And Pat,
or people need to buy more of the licenses, the license plates that go to Fish and Wildlife that have money to Fish and Wildlife. I mean, it doesn't have to be hunting. That is the model we have now for funding Fish and Wildlife, but it doesn't have to.
Correct.
Be.
And it's a model we've tried to tinker with in the past and been unsuccessful with. But to your point, is hunting less relevant now than it has been? No, I don't think so. I think, in fact, what we have now is a stronger, more passionate base. And I think they're doing a real good job. We'll talk about this in a little bit, doing a real good job of sort of explaining to non-hunters or people who may sort of eye hunting with some wariness, why it is important.
if you're in my town, which is Moncton, you know, and you go into the general store in the fall, you are in the minority if you're not wearing camo. In some parts of the state, though, if you walk down Church Street, you don't see quite as many people wearing camouflage clothing. It's not so much of a part of perhaps the culture of Burlington as it is part of the culture of more rural communities. Is there a sort of an urban-rural divide in Vermont?
Yeah, that's I mean, not just Vermont, in the entire United States. And when you look at other hunting issues that come up in other states, it's very clearly urban and rural delineation between the two sides.
The good news, though, is that even in a city like Burlington, you're not talking about an urban population that's so totally disconnected from outdoors.
Right.
Burlingtonians, they get out of the city and they enjoy the outdoors and they get to those smaller places in Vermont and they go in those general stores and they meet with regular folks out there and hunters and anglers and trappers. And so I think that in a small state with small communities, there's an interpersonal connection that is ineffable that keeps this tradition strong and I think very well supported. And, you know, maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more too, but, you know, even in some of these more developed areas, there are folks who like the idea of taking responsibility for the food that they put on their table, and hunting is probably one of the most environmentally, socially, and ethically responsible ways to do that.
And let's draw the line between farming too. Even in Burlington, farming isn't this quaint little culture. It's, you know, it's an important part of the economy and the way of life here. So farming and hunting, but in Burlington, I think, rather than in other larger cities, there's still that acceptance and acknowledgement.
We're talking today about how hunting fits into Vermont culture. And listeners, if you live or spend time in more rural parts of the state, do you see an urban-rural divide? Are you a hunter? Are you somebody who appreciates hunting culture? Or do you think it's something that we are clinging on to that's really part of the past? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Lots of people already commenting. Patsy says hunting is important to provide families with protein. Few Vermonters hunt for sport. They hunt to stock freezers, although I think some people would say they hunt to do both, for sport and to stock freezers. We got a note from Joyce who says, here in Orange County, hunter breakfasts still rule, and every general store has a deer pool where hunters register the weight of their deer on a poster out front. In the rural areas of the state, deer hunting remains a vital part of our culture. And Suzanne says, as someone who lives in a hunting mecca, the Northeast Kingdom, it's important for our economy, not just for the tourists who come to the area, but also because of the many people who purchase hunting camps and then pay taxes to our state and towns. Most people I talk to in my town, Bloomfield, know Bloomfield because so-and-so has a hunting camp there. On top of that, it keeps our herds and flocks in check. Without sufficient numbers of predators to keep their numbers down, the bear, deer, and turkey would become more like pests and less the wonderful symbols of our state that they are. Commissioner Barry, I see you.
I mean, the great comments there. And to that last point, I mean, that gets into the ecological value of hunters and hunting. I mean, particularly in the Northeast Kingdom, we'll use moose as an example. For a while, they were considered to be locally overabundant. There were a rising number of automobile accidents. There were a lot of landowners trying to regenerate forest products, and they couldn't do that. And hunters help keep those numbers down. White-tailed deer, I mean, we have an incredibly healthy deer herd right now because we keep them in balance with available food resources. That's really important. And a lot of landowners, you know, maybe even some folks that maybe post their property, they don't hunt, they're not really connected to the hunting culture, don't realize that that significantly impacts our ability to manage deer population in abundance so that they're in balance with those habitat resources. It's really critical. And, you know, to the first point that was made, Patty's point, I mean, that I think she really hit the nail on the head in a lot of ways. And that really resonates, I think, with a lot of folks.
That people hunt for both sport and to put food in the freezer.
Statistically, it's actually true. You know, the number one leading sector for increase in hunters is women. And if you look at the surveys of why men hunt and why women hunt, top two reasons why women hunt: number one, time with family. Number two, food. So, I mean, her sense of the, you know, perhaps anecdotally is actually borne out by the data that we have.
Matt Crawford, do you see the locavore movement having any impact on what we think of as hunting culture or on people who decide that maybe they'll try it out?
I sure do. And I did a story for Vermont Life about 3 years ago about the future of hunting in Vermont. And one of my sidebars that I sort of stumbled upon was, will locavore save hunting? And there were a couple authors that are Vermont-based Tovar
Cerulli,
who I think was on the last time I was on VPR. He's one of them. And there, but there, nationally, there are a number of folks like that who have sort of taken up the locavore banner and sort of used that as not justification, but sort of as impetus for hunting.
But it still must be a small number if we're not seeing the number of hunting licenses go up.
I guess, yeah. correlation is not causation. But I do think that the locavore movement is probably helping keep the numbers from falling further than they already are.
And you know, you don't necessarily have to get in the woods to respect the value of the idea of getting your food locally. I mean, in the community I live in, I have a lot of friends that aren't necessarily hunters. They love the idea when, you know, we may have a game feast, which actually we're planning this weekend. You know, we've got, I've got a bunch of, you know, wild game that I've either gotten recently or that I've, you know, from the spring, you know, turkey, you know, I've still got in the freezer, and they are so excited to experience wild game, or they support the idea that I took responsibility for this with my friends, or maybe even took my kids out. You know, we've got some fish in the freezer we're going to pull out that my youngest son caught. So even if you are not out there and you're not taking the gun and you're not, you know, taking the next step to get a license, I think that small community support for that, the idea of getting your food locally, is just as important in many ways.
And we may be in a hotbed here, of course, for the locavore movement. I think folks are really dialed into farm to table and that kind of concept. But I do see it, a lot of people who don't hunt say, hey, if you get a deer, can I have some? If I, you know, I'd love some moose meat if you sort of stumble across some, which not really an issue with me. But I do see that happening a lot around here.
Let's go to Howie, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Howie. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to make a point about hunter's education and how I feel it leads to a greater respect for firearms and for life, and that we have such a minimal instance of gun violence here in Vermont, and we have a huge population that's gone through hunter safety and has experienced that and have a respect for firearms and more knowledge about them.
Glenn, Howie, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate that. And we should mention that people who want to become hunters now in Vermont, I can't remember what the date is, but if you're born after a certain date, you have to take a hunter safety course in order to get a hunting license in the state.
That's true. And we've made it a lot easier. We have an online course now where you could actually do a take-home booklet and do a one-day course. And to the caller's great point, I mean, we had no hunting accidents last year. And if you look over the course of time, as we've done a better job educating folks on wearing Hunter Orange, which not everybody likes to do, but more and more people are doing. And more, you know, we've gotten better at our Hunter Ed courses, going through safety, explaining conservation, very important part of our Hunter Ed courses. We've seen a huge drop in the number of incidents. And even nationally, if you look at the, you know, the number of, let's say, deaths per 100,000 people in all outdoor activities, hunting is almost near the bottom. You know, football, as you might imagine, and my kids play it, so, you know, I'm not immune from that. You know, it's almost 3,000 deaths per 100,000. Hunting is down around 7 or 8. So it's one of the, which counterintuitive for a lot of people, it is one of the most safe outdoor activities that you can engage in. And I think that hunter ed programs across the country help that.
And nonetheless, and I don't mean to harp on this number, this fact that our licenses for hunting and fishing have been going down, but we looked into when the peak was of hunting and fishing licenses, and it peaked in 1974, which was probably not coincidentally the year before hunter safety education courses became mandated for people who wanted to get licenses. And so perhaps there was this blip because people wanted to get their license in before they had to take the hunter safety course in order to do that.
I think
it's actually lowering the number of people who go out in the woods.
I don't, and I think, but 1974 is a key number. Go back in time before there was an interstate highway system, and Vermont was so much more rural in character than it is now. And there was a lot of farm abandonment, and there was a lot of regenerating forests in the valley. That is perfect deer food, and we had well over 250,000 deer at the time, and Vermont was the place to go deer hunting. So there was nowhere to go but down as far as the number of license set numbers, because everybody came to Vermont to go deer hunting. And our landscape has changed so dramatically over the last 50 years that it's almost appropriate that our license numbers would drop. But here's what I will tell you is that...
Although we were just restarting turkey hunting, so that you could have seen a rise in people who were coming back to turkey hunting.
That's true. But you know what's interesting about turkey hunting, not to digress here, though, is that we don't have a turkey hunting culture through the generations the way we do with deer. So there are a lot of guys and gals out there who love to go deer hunting that don't necessarily turkey hunt. But, you know, the one thing I wanted to point out, though, is that as long as we continue to fragment our landscape and lose important habitat, and as long as land continues to get posted and is off limits, and it's doubled, and more than doubled in the last 20 years, we will see a decline in the number of hunting licenses sold. And that's why, you know, and hopefully I have a chance to talk about it, Jane, the department is launching a program to try to help increase hunter access and give hunters more opportunities of places they can go. Because until we turn that tide, I think we'll see that trend slowly trickle down, as you mentioned.
All right. Well, I'm giving you the chance to talk about it.
So, you know, recognizing that we have this increase in posted land and there's loss of access and opportunity, we are doing a number of different things. First of all, we had some policy changes. Now, because hunting and fishing is enshrined in the Vermont Constitution as a protected right, the only way to... manage the hunters on your property is to post your land trespassing to everybody. What we had the legislature pass this last year, which was, you know, we got great support from a lot of the different hunting and fishing clubs and the legislature itself, was allow you to post by permission, still be able to enforce against trespass, but manage who's on your property.
Couldn't people do that already, even if they posted their land? I mean, at least... It maybe not legally, but a lot of landowners were letting people hunt on their land who had asked them for permission even though they posted
them. That's true, but you know what? Your average hunter doesn't have the time to figure out who owns the property where the yellow posted signs are.
The posted sign, doesn't it have to have the property owner's name?
It does not. It has to have a signature, which is probably often illegible, and a date, and that's it. But under the new rule, you could post it by permission. And you'd put your, and you are required to put your information on there.
Print it, not sign it.
Yes, you'd be printed, legible information. And that would send a very different message. That's one thing. We're also trying to reach out to a lot of landowner groups, and Vermont Coverts is fantastic at reaching out to landowners individually about the importance from an ecological perspective, which we've already discussed, and from a cultural perspective for, you know, folks who may have moved here from someplace else. Giving town clerks information when people come in to post their property, why it's important to keep it open or let them know there's another option for hunting. And I think most importantly, if you go to our website now and you go to our maps pages, we have completely updated all the Fish and Wildlife property maps, have satellite image symmetry overlay. There's a lot of tools you can use. There are direct links to all the maps for National Forest Service, National Refuge System, places where we have public access easements on private property, forest and park land, and we're working on town forest lands. The upshot is that now people can have one resource. If they don't know where to go, they've lost access because it got posted, now they'll have a place where they can go and have a resource and say, okay, I can go hunting here.
We're talking today about hunting in Vermont culture. We're also looking a little bit at the ecological and economical impact of hunting in the state. And listeners, if you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Or you can share your thoughts with us on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today I'm talking with Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Patrick Barry and Matt Crawford, former outdoors editor for the Burlington Free Press. We're taking a look at how hunting fits in with Vermont culture. And if you have a question or want to share your own thoughts, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Glenn's been waiting on the line from Windsor. Hi, Glenn. Let's go right to you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to let your panel there know that in my family, hunting is a matter of economics and safety as well, because you all know in the last few years the recalls of all the contaminated food and the bad meat and things of that nature. And by hunting, you know, you can pretty much eliminate all that if you process the food yourself and take care of it. And it's also, you know, I think it's better for the animal, too, because you don't know where your meat's coming from or how they've been treated, what they've been fed or given for medications. And with deer and moose and things like that. You know, they're eating everything that's natural out there. They don't have any antibiotics in there, and it's nothing but goodness.
Glenn, thanks for your call. Appreciate that sentiment. Let's go to David in Burlington. Hi, David.
Hey, thanks for doing the show. It's a great topic. It seems like a lot of Vermonters are really interested in food. A lot of Vermonters really make food and share it with other people. I go to the farmer's market a lot. I actually quit eating meat 40 years ago, but I helped a friend set up his tree stand the other day. And I really approve of hunting and think it's a much better thing to do than factory farming to grow meat. So I'm fascinated by the show. Thanks for doing it.
Yeah, David, thanks very much for your call. And let's get another one in here. Matt in Bomazine. Hey, Matt.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment on the Hunter Orange in Vermont. I often wear Hunter Orange, and I really think it's great in Vermont that they recommend Hunter Orange, and so far they haven't required it. I really hope they keep it that way. And a comment I'd like to make on that, I think people don't really think of, is it's very important for target identification that people know what they're pointing a gun at and looking at or seeing. And I think sometimes when states just make it mandatory Hunter Orange, you have people out in the woods, especially those with bow permits or either sex moose permit, and they see something moving in the bushes and they don't see Hunter Orange. They just automatically think it's okay to put a gun on that target and aim at it and so forth. So I think that they're just recommending it is a great thing Vermont's doing, and I think they just need to push it. The hunters need to, you know, be responsible, take the hunter safety course, and know what they're seeing in the woods.
Yeah, Matt, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. And one of the things in hunter safety is that really sort of hit home notion of you need to know what you're shooting at. You have to know what your target is before you shoot, and you have to know what's beyond your target, because we are talking about firearms here. Firearms can kill more than deer and turkeys. They can kill people. And so there is this sense that you have to be very, very careful of what you're shooting out there when you're in the woods. We also got a note from Casey in Craftsbury who says, stop letting flatlanders buy up all the land and then post it against hunting. You should have to live here full time for a minimum of 10 to 15 years before you can post your land. Some of my favorite hunting land has been posted by people who aren't even residents of Vermont. Killing to eat is a balance this world can't afford to give up. Similarly, B says access to land is becoming more challenging, and the public land available isn't always managed to support wildlife. Matt Crawford, what about that? You know, we'll get Pat Berry's take, but I don't see the state telling flatlanders they can't post their land. But, you know, what about that issue?
I think that's right. And we go back to sort of the cultural divide between urban and rural. And when you have a lot of folks who come from an urban setting, or maybe who didn't grow up with hunting, or come from, I hate to use the F word, the flatlander word, but let's say away. There is that sort of trepidation about hunting. It's guns. It's people in funky looking clothing and out at all hours of the day and night, and or day, I should say, but the dark hours of the day. And I think there is sort of a little bit of a pushback from people who come who don't understand the hunting culture. I also do think that Vermonters, by and large, 7th, 8th, 9th generation Vermonters, lots of those folks post their lands for very valid reasons as well. So I don't want to blame this all on a cultural miscommunication.
A lot of the land posted right around where I live is posted by the families who've lived there for many generations. They hunt their land, but they don't necessarily want other hunters there who are taking their deer.
Right. Or it's a working forest for some reason, and there's reasons to keep folks away. Or they've got 6 or 7 or 8 generations of other Vermonters who come to the farm to hunt.
Pat Berry?
I think you guys have hit the nail on the head. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why people post. And the idea, I mean, if you look at the ecological perspective, the idea that people may post because they like the hunt themselves is important. Matt and I are loosely affiliated with a camp, Carp's Camp, and there's a guy there named Scott. He's got a whole bunch of property, and he viciously protects his land. He's like a badger, only shorter. But the thing is, he and his kids will hunt every inch of that property during the course of the year. There's tremendous value for that. And I also don't want to let hunters off the hook completely. I mean, there are bad apples that ruin every bushel, and there are folks that just do not respect landowners. They don't respect how close they may be to dwellings. And folks get fed up, and they post their property. And so, as a part, I should have mentioned earlier, as a part of this landowner, you know, sort of hunter access campaign, we are really encouraging hunters to show the utmost respect. Get permission even if it's not posted. Just find a way to show your gratitude and police your own. If you see some knucklehead out there doing something that's threatening the honest hunters out there, call the game warden or hold them accountable. Let them know you don't appreciate that.
Just a quick story. This weekend I hunted on a place that's really tightly posted, and I go with a friend who has permission to hunt there, and the farmer was out in the field spreading manure. Just luckily enough, my friend had just picked up his doe that he shot during bow season and still had unfrozen meat, and gave him a big pile of fresh venison. And that goes a long way to making sure that we have access there for years to come.
Speaking of bad apples, we got a note from Morgan who says, could you please address the lack of oversight of hunter responsibility? I've passed hunters in the woods who have clearly been drinking. Are felony charges brought against hunters who accidentally kill or wound another person? And are there laws against carrying a loaded firearm while under the influence?
There are separate laws regarding use of firearms and hunting. Frankly, there's not a lot we can often do with folks who may just be wandering through the woods intoxicated and have a loaded gun. But this goes to the point that I made earlier, which is that, you know, people need to learn to be responsible out there. And, you know, I think there's a lot of folks who go to camp and they love to have beers and stay up late and play cards. But hopefully when they wake up the next morning, bright and early, they're out there and they're focused on the task at hand, which is, you know, enjoying the great outdoors, you know, trying to bag a buck. And they wait until they get back to camp that evening before they get back into the, you know, other fun that camp offers.
Could the state change the laws, though? I mean, I think Alaska, for example, won't let you have a loaded gun if you've also been drinking. I mean, isn't that something the state could decide?
It's a pretty sensitive issue. As you might imagine, Jane, you know, sort of gun-related issues right now are very sensitive. And we had a conversation in the legislature about trying to curtail road hunting because, you know, frankly, it just makes honest hunters look bad. And there's a study committee working right now on looking at some of those issues, which may not get in as specifically what you're talking about. But I think that the community itself is beginning to have an internal conversation about, oh, making ourselves look good and having laws on the books that make sure that, you know, bad apples don't ruin it for all of us.
But that's not something that you're going to be pushing for in the next legislative session.
We're going to see what comes out of the study committee. I think there's going to be some good recommendations.
It's similarly, and Matt, then I'll give you a chance to jump in. Andrew says, similarly in terms of talking about laws, Andrew says it seems like every year or two someone's killed by a stray rifle round. Is it time for Vermont towns to limit hunting to shotguns or bows?
See, I didn't want to throw too many pieces of Play-Doh on the wall here today, but I do think that the firearm discussion does play a big role in the larger discussion about hunting. And we talk about the culture of Vermont. Now, there's a gun culture of Vermont. There's a hunting culture of Vermont. Yeah, they overlap. There's a non-gun culture that has sort of grown throughout the country, and probably for good reason, over the last 10 years. And I think that, too, has sort of scared people off who may not necessarily be hunters but may have this sort of a little bit of hesitation about what hunting is when you start bringing firearms into the discussion. Whether those are, you know, we could talk for days and days about where that is valid and what those concerns are, and the phones would light up. But I will say that is a factor.
We got a note from Meredith who says, although I'm a relatively new Vermonter, it doesn't take long to understand that hunting is a long-time tradition in the state. That said, I've never been comfortable with it myself, nor attracted to it as a recreational activity. Most of us cringe at the thought of elephant hunters, but we accept deer and turkey hunting, possibly simply based on the fact that one species is more endangered than the other. But at the base, in both instances, the same thing is happening. Humans are killing wild animals. And let's go to Brenda, who's calling in from Tunbridge. Hi, Brenda. Go ahead.
Hey. I'm a woman and a hunter and of the light variety. But one of my questions to you is, would you consider putting a restriction on the number of people who gang hunt or do drives? You know, so it's not the 15 to 20 plus people going back and forth driving the whole herd. And it does take away from the pleasure of anybody else. And if you did put a restriction of 3 or 4 like other states, it would make it easier for neighbors to be able to deal with neighbors.
Brenda, thanks for the call. So Brenda's looking for some restrictions on the number of people who can hunt together.
It's a good opportunity to explain that all hunting, fishing, and trapping regulations are not decided by the department. They're decided by the Fish and Wildlife Board, which is a separate entity. It's all board members from each county appointed by the governor. So that's something that Brenda would want to push to them. to the point of her question, the idea of deer drives is I think it still happens, but I think it's a dying method of taking deer, and it's probably going to take care of itself at some point, because there are a lot of hunters who are finding themselves preferring a different kind of chase in the woods, and frankly, there aren't the pieces of big property out there in a lot of places where you can actually have a big deer drive. So it may be... the demise of that kind of drive, that culture, may be just an artifact of history at some point.
Karen in Hardwick says, hunting and fishing are the original sources of organic, pasture-raised, wild, and sustainable meat and fish. If the Department of Fish and Wildlife had a great marketing strategy, I think we would have a chance at bringing some new people to the sports. Hunting and fishing are family traditions that are passed down from generation to generation and are an important part of Vermont's working landscape and heritage. I know you're sitting next to the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, but Matt Crawford, does Fish and Wildlife need a better strategy?
That's exactly right. I think if I were hired by hunting to come up with a PR plan, that we would use the locavore movement and food as one of the keys of that program. And I think the department in the last few years has gone, they used to do deer tallies where it would just be the total number of deer killed. And in the last few years, the department started including how much venison that translates into. So 10,000 deer equals whatever it was, 900 or over 1 million pounds of venison. That's a good strategy. There's more of that stuff they could certainly do.
Pat Barry, you got other things under?
We have finally gotten to the place where we've got a really nice, robust outreach department and some great leadership there that's looking at exactly these kinds of issues. And it's a work in progress. And as a part of this, you know, sort of hunter access and landowner campaign, we're looking at license numbers and demographics and the things we can do to try to encourage more people to get involved. And I think over the next few years, you're going to see us target some of those groups to try to bring different constituents involved into the sport.
You know, Matt Crawford works for a PR firm.
We've hired him before.
just to wrap things up here, we got a note from Virginia on that landowner question who says, I live in Middlesex. I own a large piece of land where I happily allow hunting. I simply ask for a small piece if some is bagged. So we've been talking today with Patrick Barry, Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Matt Crawford, a former outdoors editor for the Burlington Free Press. He now works with the public relations firm Pale Morning Media, which does specialize in the outdoor world. Thanks very much to both of you for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Coming up, mental illness and incarceration. Our State of Mind series continues with a look at why mental illness is overrepresented in Vermont prisons. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This week in our State of Mind series, we're looking at the increasing pressure on Vermont's mental health system. It's been in the spotlight since Tropical Storm Irene irreparably damaged the state hospital in Waterbury. We've considered acute care and designated agencies. And today, we go inside the Vermont correctional system, which is bearing a significant burden for housing and treating people with mental illness.
This is Charlie. This is our medical unit, which also houses mental health inmates. Sometimes we need separation. We've got at least two unmedicated schizophrenics in here.
Mark Putanis is the superintendent of the Southern State Correctional Facility in Springfield. One of Vermont's seven prisons, it deals with the largest percentage of inmates with serious mental health concerns. We're walking through several units where inmates with mental health problems have special housing.
Today, as of about 8 a.m., we have 356 inmates lodged. That includes people waiting to go to court, people who were recently arrested, whatever. Of that population, we have somewhere around 200 of them are on the mental health caseload.
All 200 of those inmates on the mental health caseload get counseling from just three clinicians on staff at the prison. Dr. Dolores Burroughs Byron is the Director of Health Services for the Department of Corrections. She says inmates with serious mental health issues can exacerbate existing difficulties in a prison setting.
When you have an individual who is acutely psychotic or delusional, it's like having five regular inmates. So it requires quite a bit of staff resources on the custody side, and it requires quite a bit of resources from our mental health and medical providers.
Vermont has about 1,600 in-state prisoners on any given day. Nearly a third of them are dealing with diagnosed mental health issues. That's a huge number, disproportionate to the general population. But mental health practitioners caution against associating mental illness with an increased risk of criminal behavior. Meredith Larson is the chief of mental health services for the Department of Corrections.
It does a great disservice to people with mental health conditions generally to imagine that they are somehow more criminally inclined. What we have here are people who have criminal profiles as well as mental health conditions and concerns of one sort or another.
And Neil Metzner is the director of behavioral health services at the Springfield Prison.
But I don't think it's the mental illness. I think it's the lack of treatment and the resulting instability.
Dr. Burroughs-Byron says some Vermont inmates might not be in prison in the first place if they had had access to appropriate treatment in the community.
Their ability to inhibit certain behaviors are by definition, for some of them, not going to be what yours or mine are. Then if you remove the community supports where perhaps they were going for to touch base, maybe to be fed, to have medication given to them, even for someone to say, have you seen your doctor lately? So that individual who was maybe kind of tottering on, maybe I need to have something and I see it and I want it and so I take it. So they're in trouble, and so off they go to corrections, or in they come.
She says over the years, as institutionalization fell out of favor, not enough money was put into community supports. And when the recent recession hit, nonprofits and other community programs suffered, and so did people with mental illness. Some of them ended up in prison. Adding to the problem, mental health treatment is different in prison than it might be in an inpatient hospital or outpatient treatment group. At the Springfield Prison, there is a dedicated mental health unit for inmates with significant difficulties. They engage in group therapy and individual treatment. But the clinicians, like Neil Metzner, admit it's not the same.
Our mission in corrections is really one of the here and now. We don't really delve into past traumas or issues that might trigger other emotional difficulties. What we deal with is the frustration of corrections, of being incarcerated, of the boredom of incarceration, and probably working with them a little more quickly and less in depth than you might see in the community.
They say they don't have the luxury in a prison setting of dealing with the underlying problems related to a patient's mental illness, although the therapy does sometimes have those kinds of beneficial results. They are in a prison, not a hospital, and their main focus is to make sure inmates learn to regulate behavior and conform to the confines of incarceration.
I think they're doing, with the resources they have, what they can do.
Ann Donahue is a state representative who serves on the Mental Health Oversight Committee.
I don't think anyone in corrections would try to tell you that even the special units in corrections that deal with mental health are in any way equivalent to an intensive residential program. And that's the missing, that's the biggest missing piece of care that people with the same degree of illness in corrections need.
Representative Donahue says people in prison aren't getting the mental health care they need because the state doesn't have a specialized forensic hospital for dealing with people who have committed crimes and have a mental illness.
Most states have a separate hospital system for the correctional system, or forensic hospital. We don't do that.
In Massachusetts, for example, Bridgewater State Hospital serves as a psychiatric facility for detainees awaiting trial, as well as those convicted of crimes but deemed criminally insane. Vermont has no such facility. Inmates, even those with severe mental illnesses, serve out their sentences in one of Vermont's standard correctional facilities. The head of health services for Vermont's prisons, Dr. Burroughs-Byron, says having a dedicated forensic unit would make a huge difference. It would allow seriously mentally ill people to get focused treatment that they just can't get in Vermont's current prison system, even at Southern State, where there are specialized mental health units.
They're not acute psychiatric facilities. They are mental health units or units in a correctional facility in which mental health treatment are given or the attempt is made to deliver some sort of treatment, whether it's stabilization of the individual, behavioral planning around how to best respond to them, but it is not a forensic unit.
But there are separate hospitals that are supposed to take people who are awaiting trial. Some detainees used to go to the Vermont State Hospital. Right now, the Brattleboro Retreat takes detainees. These are people who have been court-ordered to undergo psychiatric evaluation. But frequently they're not going to the Brattleboro Retreat because the retreat is full, so they're stuck in jail instead. And Dr. Burroughs-Byron says she doesn't see that changing, even when the state completes a new psychiatric hospital in Berlin.
Our population is often the population that is triaged to the bottom of the list when it comes to being transferred into one of those beds.
She says the state looks at a system that includes people in crisis waiting in an emergency room for treatment and determines that the prison population is not the top priority.
But when you look at our system and you look at it from the perspective of, I have someone who is in corrections, they're safe, they're not harming anyone, and I have someone who's in an ER who is potentially unsafe and potentially at risk, or the community is, of harm, or I have them in the courtroom, who should I triage, who should I place first on my triage list of getting that bed?
Dr. Burroughs-Byron says the corrections department alone could use 25 beds at any given time, beds they're not likely to see in the near future. Corrections Commissioner Andy Polito says there's no plan to ask the state for a dedicated forensic hospital to jail and treat mentally ill criminals. So Vermont's mentally ill will continue to be disproportionately represented in our prison system. Dr. Burroughs-Byron says the mental health staff in Vermont prisons do what they can to help people have the best lives possible. But
it's kind of sad in a way when you think that people are maximizing their potential within corrections.
And when they get out, they're released back into the community, still battling the mental demons that may have contributed to their incarceration in the first place. Tomorrow in our State of Mind series, we take a look at the issue of involuntary medication or forced drugging. And we'll take on a legislative battle that's likely to heat up this winter over whether or not Vermont needs to make this kind of intervention possible more quickly. State of Mind is made possible by VPR's Journalism Fund. You'll find all of our stories at vpr.net. And now we turn to your notes and messages to Vermont Edition. Managing producer Patty Daniels joins me to read from our virtual mailbag.
Hi, thanks, Jane. This week we interviewed military and security writer Bill Arkin about why he thinks the drive to uphold national security is eroding fundamental powers in the Constitution. And during that interview, Arkin touched on the role of the National Guard, who respond to disasters in other states. And he said that deploying soldiers from out of state represents a federal power over a state entity.
Well, Jim in Braintree says, during Irene, I received a text from my cousin, a firefighter in Massachusetts. He was part of a FEMA response team headed to Vermont to participate in the disaster response. What was amusing to him and alarming to me was that his team of about 10 people plus gear in two government vans were being escorted by two full cars of armed ATF agents.
And Jim continues, I realized it was probably part of an established security protocol, but come on, really? As my cousin put it that day, it probably had more to do with billable hours than government overreach, but it was nonetheless disturbing.
Jennifer, though, had a different take. She writes, you know, not every state has the assets needed to provide assistance for every type of disaster. For example, during Irene, we needed dump trucks to haul away dirt and stones and debris. The Vermont National Guard doesn't have those assets, so Maine, Ohio, and West Virginia sent their dump truck units. This is also true in regards to helicopters.
And Jennifer concludes, unless the state and taxpayers want to invest in making sure that our guard has every possible asset for every possible disaster, we need to get used to other states helping out. It only makes realistic and fiscal sense to do so.
Last Friday, State Senator Anthony Polina made the argument for creating a state bank and pointed to North Dakota's example. But Dave disagrees that the state bank deserves credit for that state's economic success and writes, "The chief reason North Dakota has experienced low unemployment and a strong economy is to the Bakken Shale, a special case, in my opinion."
And finally, our recent interview about traffic safety among geriatric drivers prompted this comment from Linda. "Might you choose younger and older over the words young and old when referring to people on either end of our age continuum? In 2003, my vibrant, relevant, wise, creative, hilarious colleague, mentor, and friend, Ann Durham Robinson, at age 90, clarified and requested this. There's a big difference between being older and being old. I'm 90, but I'm not old."
All right. Duly noted, Linda. Well, we always welcome your questions and comments to the show. You can find us on social media at Vermont Edition or email vermontedition@vpr.net.
And you can also join the daily discussion online for each day's show at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And we look forward to hearing from you there.
Thanks very much, Patty.
You're welcome.
That will do it for today's show. Now, tomorrow, the connection between childhood trauma and chronic disease later in life. We'll talk with one of the authors of a major study that draws that connection, and we'll learn what it means for public health experts here in Vermont. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.